I'll talk about a combination of two subjects. One is quantum communication or quantum information theory, and the other is fault-tolerant quantum computing. And this has been a long project and a steep learning curve, and I'm very grateful for my postdoc and collaborator, Alexander Miller-Hammers, with whom I did this project together. He was a postdoc in Copenhagen, and it was a very long project, took many years. So in the meantime, he managed to move to Lyon, and now he moved back to Scandinavia, where he moved to Oslo for a faculty position. It's on the archive, it's from last year, it was presented at UIP, and we're obviously working on some kind of follow-up work to this. Below you see sort of a table of funders. Denmark is blessed with the funding from private foundations. I want to highlight the Velux foundations who sponsor, maybe you know, these are windows and slanted roofs, and they have it's owned by a foundation who give us money. And Novo Nordisk is a big pharmaceutical company in Denmark, and they're also investing heavily in quantum, which is really fantastic. So let's get started. And here we go. What is, now your heads are in the way. I have to put them over. Okay, right, what is communication? Okay, so here's the paradigm from Shannon in the 1940s, okay? We're gonna get inputs, we're gonna encode them in some way, and then we're gonna send them over a noisy channel, or better said, many instances of a noisy channel. And of course you could imagine a channel being like a cable connecting two people that you use sequentially, or you could think of it in parallel, and we are thinking of it now in parallel. That is just good for us. And then we're going to decode the information and receive the output. This is the standard paradigm. Just to set a bit of notation, we're going to talk about M input bits, and we're going to talk about N channel users. And if you're doing this cleverly, what you want to optimize is M divided by N. So there is a so-called capacity people define. It's this beast here, and you should start reading in the middle. I have a laser pointer, here it is. It's M divided by N, right? You wanna get as much bits through as few channel users as possible, okay? When you use the channel optimally. So you wanna look at M divided by N, and then you wanna design your encoder and decoder. So the supremum goes over, or the maximization, right? Goes over the choice of encoder decoders, such that when you look at the output, the probability that the output differs from the input is very small, like epsilon. You chose it, 10 to the minus 8, something like that. Then you want to look at this in the large N limit, so the large channel users limit. And of course, the more N grows, the more M grows, so you're looking at this ratio. But you're really interested in small epsilon. So you fix the epsilon, but it's small, so you can at the end let it go to zero. This is the standard capacity. And Shannon actually worked himself out what the formula was, and they're better experts for how this is proved in the audience than I am, but I'm just gonna flash it. It's the maximum over something, and then it's the mutual information, it's some aggregate of entropies, of Shannon entropies, of course, and this is the formula for this capacity. So it's a function of the channel, okay? Think of the channel as being the noisy channel from me to, maybe I'm not on wireless now, but from you to your router, maybe if your computer is on wireless. All right, well, the formula itself will not be so relevant for the talk. What's more relevant for the talk is actually the definition of the capacity. If there are any questions regarding this definition, it's good to ask it now.
No question from my side.
I want to ask one.
Go ahead, Debbie.
Does the limit, the order of the limit matter, whether epsilon first or n first?
Yes, of course it matters. Yes, very important. If you change the order, right, and you have the limit out here, right, then you would demand zero error in the encoding, because then you can put the limit, you can carry it out, and it would go to, and the demand would be the zero error. And then you take the limit, this will be the zero error capacity. It's actually a different function. That's a different capacity, zero error capacity. That would be an interesting thing to look at this, but we're not gonna do this in the talk. It's actually amazing that by having this small error epsilon, you can actually tolerate it you know, a huge improvement over the zero error capacity. Okay, are there more questions? Okay, then let's continue. Oh, how much time do I have? Good question. It's anyway, we had passed my bedtime, so.
1 hour, like the talk is 1 hour in total.
1 hour. 1 hour is what's the definition of an hour?
So till your 10:30 p.m., I suppose.
Okay, perfect. So 6 hours ahead. Good. Okay, now we are doing quantum, right? Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. We do quantum communication. So we got to change the setup a little bit. Now the channel is now a quantum channel. Holevo considered this first. He noticed that actual glass fibers transport photons and they don't have to be classical, they can be quantum. And so then, of course, what you can do is then you can be very clever and use a quantum computer to decode a quantum algorithm here, and you can also do a quantum encoder. But for the remainder of the talk, we will leave the inputs classical and the outputs also classical, okay? This is just to keep the talk sort of like manageable. We can go to quantum. We can also do that quantum, but that's going to be somehow introducing for us now to bring the main point across unnecessary complications. So let's not do that. We're just going to stay with that. The real issues already come out there. Then, of course, this is now called the so-called classical capacity of a quantum channel. Okay, classical capacity because I'm still interested in sending classical information across my quantum channel, but it's now quantum channel. And then, well, it's the same formula. I don't have to change anything. It's just that now I'm take the supremum over quantum algorithms. And there is a theorem called the HSW theorem, Holevo, Sturm, and Westmoreland, who have a formula. And the formula also looks like the same. So it's fantastic. It's the same. All I have to do is I have to consider to have a quantum channel, and I have to swap out entropies by the normal entropies. It's also good. And then the formula will not be good in itself. I have to do something called a regularization. But again, for us, what is more important is the definition of the capacity rather than its formula. Any questions at this point? Okay, so what I want to do is I want to challenge that paradigm, okay? Everyone's nodding, okay, great paradigm. Okay, so we've been studying it, big books have been written about it, etc. What I want to do is I want to challenge the power. Really want to ask if is this what is going on? And it's not, in my opinion. So let's have a look at this. I think this assumption of noiseless encoder and decoder is unrealistic. Okay, it's just unrealistic. I think everyone who's ever talked to an experimentalist is acutely aware of that the qubits they produce in the lab are noisy and the gate operations are noisy, and even the most advanced way we can think of it in the future still seems to involve having error correction and having errors and not really reaching the limit of perfect physical qubits. So the assumption here of noiseless encoder seems unrealistic per se. What could happen? In my encoding, I could get errors. The gates could be hit by errors, okay? Just because this is quantum computers. So I have to do something. Well, first of all, let's sort of be clear that entirely new problems will appear. So the first question one may ask is quantum communication possible at all? It's actually not obvious. Like, it's not completely obvious if quantum communication is possible if you have noise on the encoded decoder. And then maybe a more technical question that if the first one, okay, let's hope for that things don't go haywire and communication is possible at all. That is this capacity formula continuous. So I have a noise, say I'm hitting each gate in my circuit with the noise delta. And this is a small error parameter. My channel is fixed. Think of the channel as being some 10% noisy channel or 15% noisy channel. And think of this very small, like 1%, 0.1% gate error, right? So is this formula continuous? Yes.
One question. I mean, because you said, of course, for the purpose of this talk, you just used this example of classical input, classical output. So what do you mean it's not obvious that even with noisy devices, I could not even do, basically put classical communication through the quantum channel? Because I thought that for that one, the moment you have correlations, you will be able to do classical encoding, right?
You have to tell me how. I mean, we can talk about it, but if you have what you want to convert the channel into a classical channel by putting an encoder and a decoder, by putting a measurement. Is that what you want to do then?
So you want to take a measurement
and want to convert the channel into a classical channel. And as soon as the classical channel has correlations, you can you want to say, well, then I can at least push something across the channel.
Yeah, probably what I'm doing implicitly, I assume that basically classical operations will be still noiceless. I would have a class.
Yeah, yeah. No, you can do.
And you challenge like, even that one at the moment. Okay, good.
Yeah, you can do that. You can do that strategy. In the case of where you communicate in quantum, so quantum bits, that strategy is not obvious anymore. But you see already, right? Then you basically have to say, you basically have to remove all the quantumness for your problem.
Okay.
But that's strategy.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. Just one question. So the HSTW theorem that you showed in last slide, so that is the capacity for the case when encoder and decoder are noiseless, but channel can be noisy in the quantum communication case. Is that right?
Yes, yeah. The channel is still noisy, yes.
Okay, so now you're... Yes. Exploring what happens if the encoder as well as decoder has some noise, then how does the capacity changes?
Exactly. And note, the classical scenario is actually what we observe. So in our daily life, right? You have a computer now. I have a computer. They're basically noiseless. But the communication line between, I don't know, me and my router, right, for instance, is very noisy. And so there's a lot of coding going on, but I'm precisely in that scenario. I have an encoder, I'm using my channel, which is very noisy, and I have a decoder. So, and somehow the scenario we are thinking of, so classically that doesn't appear somehow the problem, at least not to this experiment. Okay, but I claim it like happens in the quantum case, but of course I have lots of experts here, so you will immediately rebuttal and say, my God, the field of fault-tolerant quantum computing has existed since the 90s. It's a highly developed field, and Dan Gottesman was faculty here until very recently, and he was the main guy in that field. And you're absolutely right. So what is sort of what's my point here? Like somehow that should have been solved. Isn't this problem already solved? So what are you talking about here? So let me try to convince you that the problem is not solved. I have what does fault-tolerant quantum computing do? And actually, what does quantum computing do? And I have to credit Hector Bombin for explaining this to me. I have to admit, I did not understand this. In fault-tolerant quantum computing, the input is classical. You have a classical input and you have a classical output. Okay, a quantum computer is something that takes, if you look at the definition of BQP or complexity class, it takes a classical input and it spits out the classical output. In our case, and the whole theory of fault tolerance is built around this paradigm. But what we're needing is something slightly different. We have an input, it's still classical, so just like before in fault tolerant quantum computing. But now, before we put the stuff into the channel, actually the channel receives a quantum input. So if I just do naively what I have here on the left, it doesn't fit into the paradigm, okay? So I have quantum channel, so it doesn't fit. I cannot black box, Gottesman's theorems into this, not possible. And the same thing is on the output. On the output of the channel, I have to run a quantum computation, but fault-tolerant quantum computing works as taking classical inputs, but this one obviously will take a quantum output. Okay. So this is sort of like the problem. Is there some easy fix? Well, we can try. We could say, so I'm encoding everything and I'm now working in logical qubits, right? So let's assume I want to send over my channel some code word, you know, like Golevo told me what code word is optimal for my channel. I'm now preparing that code word with my fault-tolerant quantum computer, but I stop when I'm in the logical state. So I'm putting it into the logical qubits. I'm putting my code word for the channel. Okay, good. We could do that. But then the problem is that these logical qubits, they don't fit into the channel, right? If you think the channel is, say, a qubit channel, and I have a logical qubit, but it lives in this, you know, it's represented by 500 physical qubits. 500 physical qubits, they don't fit through my channel. Okay, so somehow it just doesn't fit. Well, then you could say, well, why don't I decode this logical qubit and I decode it into a physical qubit? And this is also maybe what we're doing in some sense. But note, when I decode from an error correcting code, what happens is that the thing gets hit by noise. So if I was though have chosen a careful code word for my channel and now it gets hit by noise, well, that's not the code word anymore. It's actually completely wrong. It's actually, you know, fidelity zero with the old one that I wanted to send. So that also doesn't work. So my code words will be changed too much. And this is sort of the thing we're facing, okay? And this is what we have to play and fix and to see if it can be fixed. And this is what I wanted to do. Are there any questions here?
So, Matthias, what exactly do you mean when you say that the encoded logical qubits don't fit in the channel? Do you just mean you're sending physical qubits and not logical, or?
Yeah. I just imagine I'm now, well, okay, so what's this, so if I stay, right, if I just encode my preparation of this channel code word, it will be prepared in the logical qubits. But I'm sending physical ones. So I have to somehow, you know, it's too big, right?
Maybe a basic question following on what John asked. Can you use the channel in parallel or is it like sequentially?
Yeah, we're doing now in parallel, but you can of course think that that I'm doing this sequentially, right? I'm preparing this on a block and then I'm using the channel, you know, sequentially, right? One physical object that I'm using, I'm sending the first one and I keep the rest in storage, right? And then I send the second one and so on. John, did I answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Any more questions? Okay, let's go on. Now, here's the plan for my talk. That was just planned like an intro. I want to tell you a bit about error correction and fault tolerance, at least what I will need from this topic. And then I want to tell you a bit about fault tolerant quantum I will tell you about error correction and fault-tolerant quantum computing. Then I want to go in more detail about the setup of this fault-tolerant quantum communication, which I've told you about now. And then I want to give you some key ideas in our main result. That's sort of, the idea. Okay, so let's first do some basics. Error correction. Okay, so we got started with some error correction basics. So here's the basic thing, right? If you want to do a classical bit 0 or 1, you want to encode it, you do repetition code, you say 0 goes to 0, 0, 0 and 1 goes to 1, 1, 1. This is really a great code because if you have one error, say an error happens on the middle qubit here, then you can see the smart thing is that the majority here will still tell me what the code, what the bit is, okay? So here the majority, I have 2 0s and 1 1. So I'm doing majority vote. Where are there more zeros or more ones? And then decoding correctly to the zero, I'm going correctly to the one. This is really nice code. Now, Peter Shor generalized this to the quantum setting. I stole some graphs from Wikipedia. So basically, he did this repetition code. But since quantum bits, they, in simplified way, they have a bit value and they also have a phase. Okay, so I have a bit and a phase. So I have to do this repetition code twice. So I have to do it for the bit value and for the phase value. And you see that is what happens here. I sort of have a repetition. I have three times the same thing. And then I also have inside, I have three times the same thing. Okay, so and the difference is that I do it once with the plus. So this is for the plus phase and this is for the minus phase. And this way I can encode one qubit into 9 physical qubits such that they withstand the error, one error. And there is a nice construction, a circuit that you can write down. And the circuit works like this. You're on top of my graph again here. Sorry, it's all recorded. Right. This is the encoding circuit for the short code. Okay, so you see here, right? The qubit comes in and then it's being like controlled knotted twice. Then there's some Hadamards, and then it's being controlled knotted again. So it basically, these control knots, they do these like entangled Greenberger or Zeilinger states here. And then it's being hit by an error, one error somewhere. And then I can successfully decode again to the Psi. Okay, now what if the gates have errors? Okay, so you see this, the thing that happens here in the short code is that the short code is designed such that you have this nice encoding circuit, then the error hits, and then you decode, okay? But that's not what's gonna happen in reality. What's happening in reality is that while you encode this thing, an error will happen, for instance, on the Hadamard gate up here. Okay, but now the stupid thing is that the error will spread, namely through these C knots. It will just be copied over here. So it's really bad because now actually we're here, but the code withstands only one error, but now it gets 3 errors. So fault tolerant or errors in encoding and decoding circuits can be really bad. And so the error correction can fail. And actually, I think it fails. So one has to be more clever in designing error correcting codes. And this is, of course, a huge research subject to design error correcting codes that have better properties than the short code here and help. I want to make one other point, which is sort of trivial, but I want to emphasize it. It also took me longer to understand than I believed it would. Namely that it's a completely trivial statement. You cannot protect an unprotected qubit. Okay, so if I give you a qubit and I want to give you an example here. So imagine now that that everything is fine, right? Everything is fine. I have my qubit perfectly encoded in this short code. It's all beautiful. And I'm thinking, okay, great. But now it's in my logical thing. I want to get it down to the physical thing. Okay, so I'm taking this qubit, which is nicely protected. I'm decoding it. And then what can happen is just in this last step, okay? In the very last step, it might be hit by an error. Okay, so if I have a qubit and I bring it out of its protecting logical subspace, bring it back to the physical space, it cannot protect it anymore. Because just if I think I have it protected, just in the last step when I want to get it out, it might be hit by an error. So it's a little bit of a trivial point, but I want to make it, and we will see it coming back later. Okay, these are the two points on error correction I want to make. Now, what is going to happen here? Yeah, okay, so this was sort of error correction 101, the take homes. Yeah, let's do fault-tolerant quantum computing. Okay, in fault-tolerant quantum computing, you see we want to be more clever than that. We get input, which is some classical bits. Imagine it's like a big number. That was the product of two primes, like in Shor's algorithm, okay? Like the input is the bits of like just some gigantic number, and you're asked to run Shor's algorithm, okay? What you're gonna do is you're gonna take the input and you're gonna encode it. So you put it in some quantum error correcting code. Then you're gonna take Shor's algorithm and you encode it into some encoded form of Shor's algorithm. And then you're gonna decode it into the classical output information. This is sort of like the paradigm of what the community thinks. And then the output is P and Q, right? The two factors of cubic number. And the thing why this works is that we have classical information and we think it to be stable. Okay, so the classical information is assumed to be stable. You could think of like one wire where it's hardwired, what the input qubit is, and you can read out that wire many times, for instance. Or you can think of that there's a classical code who provides that input. So it's assumed to be stable already in an error correcting code, both at the input and output, and it's classical. That's the paradigm. So we somehow need to pull the scenario off from somewhere. So it's protected from errors that happen here because we can read out this input many times. But the encoding and the encoded circuit is constructed in such a special and elegant way that the errors do not spread, at least not too fast. So this encoded circuit will constantly be undertaking some kind of error correction the whole time. But it's constructed in such a way that when the code corrects errors, it corrects more errors that it introduces by running the error correction itself. So you can think that if the code has this property that somehow every time I error correct, I remove more errors than I introduce, then if I do it often enough and so on, then it will work. And that is sort of like the idea behind fault-tolerant quantum computing, that you have this sort of trade-off. But if you run Shor's code, like I showed you before, you know, like one error happens and then the thing is gone. Okay, so that's no good. So you have to have some special construction. All right. Oh yeah, now what errors? We decided for our paper to assume that every location in the circuit is hit by independent and identically distributed errors of a Pauli noise model here with error strength delta. That was the gate error. You can generalize this error model, but the paper was already kind of long, so we decided to actually go with like this fixed model. And you will see, I will argue, I think it can be generalized, but the real issues don't lie in the fact that this is just an IID. So it's not a big simplification. All right, any questions at this point? Okay, still, okay, gadgets. So now how is this done? Let's look a little bit under the hood. So what people do is they start off with a circuit, they pick a universal gate set, for instance, this one here, and you see already what is kind of important in my gate set is not just a gate set, it also has things like prepare a zero or partial trace, stuff like that. Then you take the circuit, you write it like this, and then you encode it. So you take every gate and you replace it by a so-called gadget. Okay, so you basically every gate will be encoded in like will be a gate on a larger number of qubits, and every qubit here will be replaced by qubits in a code. So for instance, for our work, we then the statements will hold for the 7-qubit Steen code, okay? And all these transformations here, they all have like error corrections on top here and there, left and right. But that's roughly the idea. And when you follow this idea, the entire circuit will be blown up to be like a bigger circuit on, 7 times more qubits. And then you have suppressed the error, okay? A little bit, somewhat, okay? So let me just go through this again. So or here what is the 7-qubit Steen code? I thought I'm going to write it down for you. You see, it looks a little bit like the Shor code, but it has fewer elements and it only has 7 qubits. So it's a more clever construction. And a really good paper is the paper by Alifera, Scottisman, and Preskill. It's really rigorous and readable. On this topic, and that is why we started off with that paper and continued from there rather than continuing at some other point. But I guess one has to choose. So in the subject, one has to choose, you have to choose some kind of thing that you start off with. It seems to be what you have to do. That's what we did. It's very, very difficult to do some things that hold for anything in the field. You have to somehow choose your corner and work with that corner forward to get somewhere. Okay. And then there are some gates are particularly nice. I'm just mentioning these are transversal gates, so gates that basically then break apart and are composed out of simpler gates. And then there's an important concept. The concept is of concatenation. So we've shown you how to do this once. And the concept then is that you do it many times. So you, for instance, take this, get this gate here, you map it to this a new gate here, and that again breaks down, in this particular case, it looks like that. And then you take each of these gates and again, you replace them, okay? So you can do this in layers. So you see, like you have here, you have 7 qubits and then you have 49 qubits and then you continue. So it goes very fast. The growth goes very fast but there's a nice advantage that the encoding gets better in every level doubly exponential. So the growth or the improvement in quality is doubly exponential. It's very fast. So you don't really need that many levels in order to go very far. All right. How does decoding work? Well, you error correct and you decode. So just the same way, but the other way around. Now, here is the threshold theorem by Alifiers, Gottesman, Preskill from 2006. There's a question, Anna.
Yes, hello. I'm not quite familiar with these gadgets, but just like on my first reaction to the pictures you showed would be that this becomes much more intensive in terms of hardware. You need more and more components. So is it really that useful?
This is a good point. And I think that is why people are working very hard. And I think Michael is probably more expert than I am on this question. I mean, we chose now this paper by Alifiers, Gottesman, Preskill is sort of like, well, I'm not sure on the history, but I think it's sort of like the first really rigorous paper that you can read on the topic now. And it gives you some threshold and the technique is certainly something that you probably don't want to use, but it gives you a rigorous method of arguing. And we wanted to build at least our work on this rigorous level. And then in the next step, we want to go to more reasonable approaches, right? And go in that direction. But we wanted to get like some foundational result first along, you know, in the spirit of Alifiers, Gottesman, Preskill. But maybe I should hand off to Michael.
Maybe just to comment, the overhead of something like this scheme by Alifiers, Gottesman, and Preskill is going to be polylogarithmic, which is still not that bad. But then more recent work by Daniel showed that you could actually do fault-tolerant quantum computation with constant overhead. But that relies on using particular codes, LDPC codes.
Great. And maybe just to follow up on that, is like, let's call it the recipe for getting rid of the errors, like really tailored to the specific algorithm you want to run?
No, it's a general thing. It's more about the kind of noise model you're trying to correct. And then for various assumptions on the noise, you can prove threshold theorems.
Yes, so you will see now, we'll talk about something called the threshold. And maybe we can discuss this more, come back to that again. Does it make sense, Anna? I can't see you.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Okay, here's the theorem. Okay, so let me write down the theorem and we'll see what goes. Okay, so basically you want to really approximate this perfect quantum computation on the right here. That's your goal, okay? You want to simulate that with a noisy machine. And so the theorem, first of all, says that, yes, it's possible. Okay, what does this approximate mean? It means there is a so-called threshold delta such that if your noise is below that threshold, and if you now take a circuit and an input, okay? So you take a circuit, and let's say the circuit has, you know, this many gates, number of gates. Then the theorem says the probability of the output after K level encoding at delta noise, okay? So you fix the delta noise, you encode now K times concatenation. The probability that is not equal to the output at zero level, so the unencoded circuit, and at zero noise, so no noise, so this is like the right-hand side and this is the left-hand side. This probability is bounded. And now it's bounded, it's a union bound over the number of gates. Okay, so that's why we see here order number of gates. And then is some doubly exponentially dropping case. So delta has to be smaller than delta zero. So if you just set delta to be a half times delta zero, then you will have the number of a half here. And then it's a half raised to the power of 2 to the k. Okay, is the number of levels. So you don't really need that many levels. But as Michael pointed out, The number of levels will scale with the number of gates because you need to suppress that factor, right? You want to get that number here, like the total number of the right-hand side small. And so, yes, so that leads to a polylogarithmic overhead, and there are better theorems these days. But our thing doesn't apply yet for these better theorems, for these better codes. They're better also, yeah. But that's really for future work. Is there any questions on the statement? Otherwise, I can come back to this question of the threshold, right? Gottes von Alleferis Preskill, they say there is a threshold, and I don't know what it was, 10 to the minus 6, something like that? Maybe Michael knows. 10 to the minus 6, I think, was sort of like the estimate for that thing. But now people have done numerics, and they have done other codes, like surface codes, where it can be shown that these thresholds are in the percentage level. So a lot of work has improved it. But then often it comes along with a less rigorous formalism, at least that seems to be the case. I'm very happy to be shown other work which we could use where it's easier to plug in. But so that's why we stuck to this original thing. Okay, I'll just continue. So what is now this Foltorian capacity? Foltorian capacity is now, well, I mean, capacity at zero, we need to understand capacity at zero norms, right? That was the original formula we had from before. N was the number of channel users. The supremum goal was over encoder and decoder pairs. And we have to understand the capacity at delta norms, okay? And it's the same formula, okay? It's just that everything's the same. It's just that now I'm still going over encoder decoder pairs. It's just that I want the probability of input not equal to output to be below epsilon, even though every location in my circuit gets hit by delta error, okay? Independently and identically distributed over all positions in the encoding circuit. And now comes the crucial point. That this capacity here, it's a function of the channel, of course, but it's also a function of delta. So delta is a constant, okay? So the noise is not allowed to decrease with growing n, okay? So I'm using really like, I'm really shooting up n, the number of channel users, but my machine stays the same. It's this machine that every qubit is being hit by delta error. And think of delta as like the small number, like 10 to the minus 6, or I don't know, 10 to the minus 3, whatever your machine can do. 1% noise, but think of the channel as being some very noisy beast. I don't know, 20% noise. Okay. So we have these two things, right? So we have the capacity at delta noise, we have the capacity at zero noise. And any questions? Yeah, so here comes the threshold theorem. Threshold theorem says there is a threshold delta. You know, it's in the spirit of Gottesman, so the threshold would be equally small, such that if you are below, right, then your capacity at delta noise is lower bounded by the capacity at zero noise, okay, minus some fudge factor. The important thing is that, well, clearly, when I put noise on it, the capacity can only go down, right? So capacity at delta noise is smaller than the capacity at zero noise, clearly. Right? It will not be better. It's being hit by noise. It can only get worse. But it's not getting much worse. It's actually the same as the zero noise minus some little function that just depends on delta. So the capacity is continuous in delta. Now, depending on which of our theorems you choose, but the function will depend on the channel and with some function that goes to zero as delta goes to zero. So in that sense, the capacity is continuous. Pointing out that the level can depend on n, but that doesn't concern us, so that's okay in the encoding, and so this is sort of like our main statement, right? And I'm now basically telling you how it's constructed. It's constructed in a very particular way. It's already kind of now contained here. This is an example of a general circuit. Namely, it's a circuit that looks like this Foltorian quantum computing circuit where I encode and I decode, but I'm now decoding and I'm putting it into a channel and then I'm encoding and I'm getting it out. That's the idea, but I'm facing all the problems that I'm facing, because when I cannot black box the result in, because I'm outputting quantum information here and not like in the fault-tolerant quantum computing, I output classical. Good. Any questions?
How fast does f of delta go to zero, and what does that light depend on?
That depends on. It's entropic quantities for one thing. So, like entropies, like binary entropy of delta terms of this type. Okay, of this type, they will appear there. And you will see a little bit in my argument later how they appear and why, maybe. Mm-hmm. A little more about that. But it depends a little bit. For the classical capacity, we have to regularize. And then in this regularization, these things will start to depend on the channel. And so we actually cannot, they are actually things that depend on the channel and how far you need to regularize. So it's not, you would hope for better for CQ channels, or for channels where the capacity is additive, we have better bounds. There it actually is uniform. It only depends on the dimension and not on the channel. Okay. More questions? Yeah, how does the proof go? Here's the outline. Okay, so the first thing that we're doing in the proof is we are going to show that the original scenario, so we're going to take this one, want to show this here is the same as the noiseless case. So what we're going to do is we're going to make some kind of effective channel here. We're going to build some kind of effective channel out of this. And so we can show that in the first case, we get rid of the noise. We can kind of like get rid of the noise here. So we can like unencode our circuit. But instead of having our nice channel from before, we now have this big gray box that we don't really know what it does. And it also is actually correlated across the channels. Okay, so it's more complicated object. And then in the second step, we want to show that the effective capacity or the effective channel has a similar capacity as this previous one. That's the two-step process. First, going to get rid of the noise. We're going to get some terrible coding problem, and then we're going to solve this coding problem. So that's the two-step process. So let's look at how that works. So here's how a single decoder works. And actually, the Horodetsky's, Mazurek et al. In this paper have shown that that kind of like the intuition is what I showed you before, that if you take a logical qubit and you start decoding that qubit, that at the very end, it might be hit by a gate error. So the total noise here is at least delta, order delta. But now, because the protection is so fast, actually, it's sort of an exponential sum. And actually, in total, it's only order delta. Okay, so it's kind of like the noise that's hit you in the last step is the worst thing that can happen to you, in some sense. So you can really think of this decoder as like the perfect decoder, as if nothing happened, plus delta level noise. That's sort of like the intuition. Now, if you have several decoders, then what happens though is that the noise gets correlated in some way. And how does it get correlated? It gets correlated because each time you decode, you get an error syndrome. So there is an error syndrome of what decoding happened. And this error syndrome can be correlated across the channels. And because the error syndrome can be correlated, the noise will be correlated. Okay? So we'll have some correlation problems. We'll get like the good stuff plus some correlated noise. And so so how do we now construct this ideal, this effective channel? The way it works is we're going to insert, like it's sort of like a theoretical operation, we're going to insert the identity up here, and we're going to write the identity as a decoder and an encoder. Okay, so if you imagine, right, what's an identity operation? Well, I'm taking a logical qubit, I'm decoding it, and I'm encoding it, and I'm making no errors. Okay? This is a really great operation. Okay, it's a logical identity gate. So I'm going to put that in here, and I'm going to put that in everywhere. And I'm going to also put it in here, okay, just because it's so nice. So in this case now, I have this so I have a perfect decoder now. You see, this object I introduced had no noise. This is exactly, I think it's called the threshold dance in the Goddess Model Affairs paper. So this perfect decoder, you can now pull through to the left, okay? So it's kind of like pulled through, and it removes by assumption that everything was good, it removes all of the noise here. And it does that here, and it does that on this other side. So what you get is like the perfect encoder, okay? All that happens is that you get this error syndrome, which can be correlated as I explained before. And now you do the same on the other side, okay? So don't worry about that. And now you see that everything's perfect, really beautiful over here. You've got these yellow error syndromes, and you've got these new channels here in the middle, okay? These are now your effective channels, and actually they're tensor product. But what is not tensor product is that these error syndromes come in and they correlate the noise. Okay, but you see here, the channel is really a qubit to qubit channel, plus it takes like a huge error syndrome in, okay? So it's kind of like, instead of our original channel, we now have this like qubit to qubit channel, but it takes this huge error syndrome, like gigantic, like millions of qubits maybe. Okay, but because everything was perfect on this side, the syndrome state is decoupled from the input, but it's correlated across. And now here we use our intuition, right? The Horodetsky intuition says that this is really just the identity channel plus a little bit of noise. So we're tracing out there. And so what we're getting is like some effective channel, which really looks like I have the original channel and it's decorated with a little bit of noise in the beginning with a little bit of noise at the end and an error syndrome that correlates the noise. Okay? So the next thing we have to do, so this is what I wrote here, all right? So it's really like my nice original channel plus an error syndrome, which I want to trace out. And then I have this channel here. And the error syndrome kind of correlates the stuff down here. Okay. So now what I need to do is I will need to reduce this. I mean, I need to get rid of this error syndrome, okay? Because it's just too nasty and it's correlating my noise. And what we're using for that is a baby version of the so-called post-selection technique, which means it's in essence, there is a worst error we can find and the worst syndrome state. And we remove that. And this gives us also the biggest error in our whole procedure. At the end of the day, this is sort of like the dominating aspect, but we managed to remove it, okay? Great. So now we're here, and now we use standard random coding for capacity. We need explicit bounds. We have to like dig them out of the literature. And we know the Holevo capacity is continuous in delta. Then we can regularize, and then everything is good. And if we don't need to regularize the bounds, we can get it even better. So this is sort of like the way we reduce the problem. And maybe I guess we're kind of done now. I maybe want to emphasize, when we look at the theorem the last time, I want to emphasize what happens. What happens really is, okay, so I showed you this thing, right? We removed the noise, we managed to show that this stuff here, right, essentially results in some noise on top of the channel. But you see that, therefore, what you have to code for is not the channel, the original channel, okay? So I said before, the natural reflex would be to take your channel to produce the nice code word for it, but in the logical subspace, okay? This is not what you should do, because the effective channel will not be the channel here. What you have to produce is the thing in the logical subspace, which is good for the effective channel, okay? For a channel with a bit of noise. And once you've done that, you can decode it, right? And then let it flow through the channel, okay? So this is the moral of the story is you need to find out what the effective channel is. You need to code for the effective channel, and that you can do fault tolerantly in the logical subspace. With this, I'm done. Yeah, of course, positivity, continuity are corollaries for this. And then I think this is a new paradigm for fault tolerant, new paradigm of fault tolerant quantum communication. We define the capacity. We showed some basic properties also for the quantum capacity. And I think it's relevant in quantum communication, maybe not at this particular moment because we're rarely doing these complicated encodings yet. But theoretical, because actually it establishes that standard quantum channel theory that I think also a lot of people here contributed to and is actually the appropriate model. Okay, so it, like in hindsight now justifies that these theorems that we have about the HSW and so on are actually going to be the ones that are practically relevant in practice. Experimental, this gives a way of now doing constructions, and I think this is something that I really like to go in the direction of doing. But I also think, as a final remark, that I think it has a broader relevance in quantum computing. Okay, so we now think of this like Alice Bob, you know, Europe, Canada, Europe, North America, Denmark, Canada, kind of scenario. But really, this is not the relevant scenario. The relevant scenario will be several small quantum computers connected by noisy communication lines, and everyone who has seen a superconducting qubit with your own eyes. You know, it's something that will not happen to a modern day transistor. You will have a hard time seeing a single one with your own eye, but a superconducting qubit, you can see it with your own eye. And once you realize, it's actually a scary thought because there's very few that are actually going to fit into one of these fridges. So you need to have many fridges and you need to connect them with wires. And then you are exactly in the setup, right? You need to communicate and you need to exchange quantum, and the machine is noisy. I mean, you can play with the available hardware and it seems hard to imagine that the noise will go away. So I hope I convince you for this. We have a nice group here in Copenhagen together with the mathematical physics crowd, and we're going to expand in the future to come. This was in our outing very recently, so we're back to normal, luckily. And we can also jump or we attempt to. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks a lot, Mathis, for the very nice talk. Everyone, let us thank him. So now, if anyone has any questions, you can unmute yourself and ask.
So, how big is the threshold for something like that?
I don't know. Like Gottesman, like, I mean, the thing that we did is just following the Gottesman construction. So it will be of the same order of Gottesman's, but there is no reason, I don't see any reason why not all of the fault tolerant literature could be plugged into instead of what we have been doing. So I don't think there's anything fundamental with that. We just chose our poison, right? But whatever the threshold theorems are and the numerical thresholds are and the percentage level, why not? It probably will be true here too. And also that counts to the generalization of other noise models and slightly more correlated noise. I don't see any obstructions there. It's just that it's at some point you got to pick something and stick with it.
Did you prove things about other capacities in your paper than the
capacity? We proved it for the quantum capacity also, yeah. Yeah, we do it all for quantum capacity, yes. It's a little more tricky because then you need to say what it means, right? So either the qubits need to come in already in a fault-tolerant code, right? Or you need to say, well, I do it under measurements. So this would be I'm producing like these EPR pairs and then it's like under measurements, they behave correctly. And this is like what we do. There are different options of how to do it. And then, but I think it's straightforward in many ways.
Thanks.
So this is more a question on the paper than the talk. Say, if you want to approach the capacity, the block length typically has to grow. So the small alphabet N is large. The encoder and the decoder has certain complexity. So say that the encoder itself is polynomial because it's a cryptic code. If you want to achieve, say, the
why is it encoder polynomial?
Because we can pick a random Clifford code to in a certain subspace to attain the capacity. The code is worse, but thanks to Benny and Alexei Kataev, they have a decoder that is at least known to be polynomial.
An encoder, you mean?
A decoder. The encoder is known to be a random Clifford, and then the decoder can be built in terms of a repeated use of a certain encoder.
Okay.
I remember there are four
uses. I didn't look into this, no, but yeah, fantastic, yes.
So it's good, but then the problem is that it still grow with the block size. And for the fault tolerance version that involve not the LDP C code, but the concatenator code, the overhead is actually it grows slightly with block length. It is not a constant overhead.
No, it's not constant overhead. No, what we're doing is not constant overhead. In the code, yes. The code has to grow as N grows, yes.
And what I remember is that in the paper, you actually just pick a cutoff to the block length and turn some of this overhead to become a constant.
No, I think that, I mean, you have to grow the block length, right?
Right.
And then you get an overhead that scales with, I mean, in the encoding, right? The qubits, the protection will have to grow. So, I mean, the protection for the qubits for the logical qubits will have to grow.
Right.
But maybe we can, I mean, if you have a very specific question to a specific part of the paper.
Concern is just that because we do not know the trade-off between the error and the block length very well for just about any channel, it turns a fairly concrete, nice scheme that you guys proposed into things that start to feel a little less specific unknown, because there is this unknown parameter.
I don't understand. Is it now a question about the coding, about the noiseless coding, or about the fault tolerance aspect?
The channel code has this block length parameter that is growing, and that is the growing size for the circuit. Yeah, it then burden the circuit part that has imperfect components. And that circuit is growing, and the overhead is a growing function of the circuit size.
Yes.
And then I need to take n to the infinity from the capacity formula. Then my circuit is infinite.
No, I mean, the circuit grows. Yes, the circuit will always grow as some kind of function of n, right? The circuit size. But of course, what you want somehow is that the circuit size grows only linearly or polynomially with the number of channels n.
So there seem to be some aspect of the problem that is actually still pretty outstanding.
I'm not saying this. I don't think it's solved. I mean, I don't think that's the end of it. I think it's the start of it. But surely, I mean, also the capacity achieving codes that we're using here actually, you know, are random codes, and they need extension size circuits. So, but luckily the Gottesman thing, right? So the protection is doubly exponentially fast. So there's no problem with running this whole fault tolerance thing on exponential size circuits. But if you have faster, if you have smarter circuits, like smaller circuits for encoding, decoding, this is great. But maybe I'm not understanding them. The question properly. But the circuit will have to grow as a function of n. I think that's, no? But maybe we can continue later in some other format.
I have a question, like in the inequality that you showed, capacity for delta error is greater than capacity for zero noise minus f of delta. So what are the properties of this function?
Oh, delta? F of delta
is it a polynomial?
I think maybe it goes in the same direction, the question. I mean, it's just a function that goes to zero as delta goes to zero.
Okay.
It would be nice to improve it and have more explicit things, but it does depend on on the regularization in the HSW theorem in this particular case. So it will be nicer. It's nicer for additive cases, but I don't think any of these answers are definite, okay? I think these are sort of like proof of principle. There is this function that goes to zero as delta goes to zero. But if we want to do this actually in practice, we want to choose the right codes, both for the channel and for the fault tolerance, such that, you know, these things work out. I mean, it's just showing that in principle it should be possible.
John, you have a question?
Oh, I was just going to say, if your channel has nice properties, like if it's degradable for quantum, or if you just know it has if you don't need to regularize the capacity formula, do you still need to regularize in the fault tolerant case? Like, do you lose that property when you start nesting?
No. It's then, no, we don't need to. I don't know. Okay. So we don't really have the formula for the, yeah, so we don't have a formula for the capacity delta, right? We just have a bound.
I see.
So whether or not, like, now, this is, of course, a very interesting question. Now, put the delta in there, right? And then look at the capacity. And then ask the question if that needs to be regularized. Well, I don't know. But since in the cases where we're looking at the where the normal capacity is additive, there in our case, this function f of delta, the Fudge factor, is only dependent on the dimension, right? So then it's uniform in the channel itself.
Is it something like log dimension times like entropy of delta?
It's something standard, you know, not something that we know from other, it's like an entropic thing, right?
It's the thing that shows up whenever you look at something, like whenever you want to use continuity of entropy.
Yeah, exactly.
You have this issue that it kind of has the derivatives go to everything diverges at zero, I think. Is it the same reason?
Yeah, yes, it's the same. I mean, these terms come out and then you use continuity of entropy, but you also get this, you use continuity of entropy, essentially. You get some other factors related to that.
Sure.
But it's not something unexpected. But I think it's a good question. I mean, you see, the problem with defining the capacity at delta, right, and studying it in its own right, it's not something you would want to do, I think, because it will depend on the circuit model that you choose. You know, it will depend on the gate set, will depend on the noise model, will depend on all sorts of stuff. Mm. So I think it will be hard to agree on a definition. You would have to have some definition, you know, that makes sense there. I don't know.
I mean, maybe for Pauli channels, if you allow Clifford operations, then maybe you have this Clifford hierarchy at each level, and you could at least pin down gauge that.
Yes. Yeah, you can try to do something like that, and then, but I'm wondering how fundamental it then becomes. I think like the most pressing things are getting the threshold up and understanding what is going on there in other codes.
Has anyone tried to show it experimentally in any kind of small circuit model or something?
I'm sorry?
So has anyone tried to show this experimentally in some kind of circuit model
setup? I don't know. Okay. No one has done things like that, I think, experimentally. I think actually the closest literature that people are in spirit trying to do similar things is in the quantum repeater literature. But I don't think they have these, maybe Norbert knows something about that, but I don't think they have these type of theorems that it actually is possible, like that you actually can reach the. But people in the repeater literature certainly are aware of the fact that when you do these things, then you get errors. But I don't think like formal statements of this type have been obtained.
Okay, thank you. Are there any more questions? If not, let us thank Matthias once again.
Well, thanks for having me.